Rip up that calendar, it's time for another flat chat. And if lockdown 3 is becoming a bit of a drag and you're suspecting lockdown 4 is going to be even worse than Superman 4, some listeners may have to look that up. Help is at hand in the form of the latest issue of GP Racing magazine, and it is the 300th issue of GP Racing, no less. Well, I suppose technically the 12th issue of GP Racing, maybe, but you know, we had a long previous life as F1 Racing. Digressing already, and we're already only 2 minutes in. Joining me to celebrate this staggering achievement of longevity are, with new prison haircut from home, Ben Anderson.
Hello, yes, I've had a special low, super low downforce trim to celebrate our landmark achievement, and also to help me cope with lockdown 3.0, or are we 3.0 now? Yeah, I think we're 3.0, aren't we?
Yeah, 3.0.1. I'll be joining you on that once it's thawed here in sunny Surrey, and we can, you know, shave my head and get the vacuum cleaner out to clear up the shavings without fear of driving the cats out of the house into the snow and ice. I'll be joining you on that. And joining us from some way further distant, it's a g'day cobber from Adelaide to Mark Gallagher.
Nice to be joining you. I didn't realise it was the 300th issue. I probably should have read all the bump before we started the recording, shouldn't I? So that's a congratulations to everyone on the magazine.
Listeners will find an inescapable side issue going on here. There's the sound of crickets in the background. You genuinely are, you sound like you're out in the outback ready to do some sort of live grub eating challenge.
Well, I have to say, I'm sorry guys, but I'm not on lockdown. We don't have any COVID here in South Australia, so we're
we
have no COVID at all. We have nothing. There, in fact, today they announced that not only is there no COVID, there's no one suffering from COVID, there's no one being treated for the after effects of COVID. There's no COVID in South Australia. So we have normality here, which is, I'm having survivor's guilt telling you this fact, that there's really normal life here. And I am, you know exactly where I am, about an hour north of Adelaide, the Barossa Valley. If you've ever had a bottle of wine from Jacob's Creek or Penfolds, those wineries are about 2 miles from where I am.
Ah, so that's why you've gone over to Australia.
Exactly. It's to drink wine and also get away from COVID. So it's been quite a good...
Success on both counts.
Quite a good combo.
Have you made a pilgrimage to the spot where Michael Schumacher took out Damon Hill in the Australian Grand Prix that time?
Well, I'm going to name drop and say I was actually talking to Damon Hill about that very thing last night, no less, just working with Damon on something. And, you know, the Adelaide Grand Prix circuit is, of course, still very much alive. At least it's there. In fact, last week I was with a guy called Tim Possingham who puts together a thing called the Adelaide Motorsport Festival, and they kind of celebrate Adelaide's motorsport heritage, of course, not just the Formula One Grand Prix when it was here, but also the Clipsal 500, you know, the Aussie V8 races, all of that, which, in fact, unfortunately, have all been given up. And there's a hope that, at least on the far side of COVID, that they will get their Aussie V8 race back and may even get the Motorsport Festival going again. And they really miss having Formula One here in South Australia and in Adelaide. And again, last week, just not long after I got out of my mandatory 14-day quarantine when I flew into Adelaide, I was very privileged to go and look at a private race car collection, which includes a number of absolutely delectable Formula One cars from not just the modern era, but right back to the 50s and 60s, Jack Brabham's 1958 Cooper being one of them. And so the passion here in South Australia for Formula One remains undiminished, and it's one of the reasons that I really enjoy coming here.
I did go to Adelaide for a race once, the race of 1,000 years that, I suppose, difficult to call it the American
Le Mans Series.
Lasted
1,000 years?
Well, the idea
How
was
old
that
are
it was,
you, Connors?
I'm like Methuselah. The idea was that it was sort of to celebrate the millennium, even though it was sort of like New Year's Day 2001 or something. But yeah, Audi sports cars, one of which was painted up to look like an alligator or something. It was I seem to recall someone stuffing it into a wall at some point. But yeah, it was good. I visited the spot. I went to another slightly less famous crash spot, the pit lane entry where David Coulthard stuffed his Williams in, I think, the 95,
yeah.
Yeah. And of course, at the time, you thought that was a work of staggering incompetence. But when you actually stand there, it is actually tighter than it looked on TV. The angle made it look a much more simple task. And quite a lot of people had difficulty turning into that pit lane that weekend. But we digress, because we have a little bit of housekeeping to attend to. Public service announcement alert. Because of the lateness of the pre-season test this season, I'm committing horrendous tautologies here, but yeah, the postponement of the Australian Grand Prix and the hideous lateness of the Bahrain test has put us in a bit of a quandary. So we've pushed back the publication date of the next issue of GP Racing until 19th of March, and that is to enable us to create a season preview issue which actually has pictures of this season's cars in and the drivers in their kit, and to keep us up to date on the latest talking points. And in order to make sure that subscribers get their value for money, we will, by the simple virtue of hard work, make up that time lag over the following few months, including which is it September that's going to be 3 weeks, Ben?
I think it's August. Maybe it's August that we have to do the 3 weeks for the September issue, just to make it even more confusing. And I should also add to your public service announcement that the next issue doesn't mean the one that's due out on Thursday. We have actually done that one. We haven't just been taking the last 6 weeks off. There is an issue of GP Racing about to hit the shelves on Thursday, but then you will have to wait until the 19th of March for the season preview, owing to the schedule adjustment that Formula One's made.
Exactly. Normally, you know, the teams would be pulling the wraps off their new cars right now, and we would be seeing those cars in action in just a few weeks' time. But yes, COVID has nudged everything along. It's while we're sitting here in our houses rather than sitting around that weird medium-style table, at the seance table in our offices in Richmond with all those posh microphones. But so there is a new edition of GP Racing on the shelves at the moment. And on the cover, we look at Ferrari's plans to build back better. And also, we count the cost of COVID-19 to Formula One, which remains a moving target owing to the schedule. But Mark, you've written that feature and you've sort of delved into the planning and the financial engineering that went into enabling the last season to happen. And Formula One made it actually look quite straightforward, didn't it? But you only have to look at the total haulics that tennis seems to be making of itself just down the road from you in Melbourne. I think that shows how difficult it is to make sport happen at the moment.
There's no doubt at the present time here in Australia, there's a lot of debate going on about the wisdom of ATP Tennis and Tennis Australia deciding to bring over 1,200 players and their entourages and the media and members of the governing body into Melbourne at precisely the same time Formula One has decided, along with the Melbourne Grand Prix organisers, to postpone the race until November the 28th. And as you say, Cotters, the thing here is that Formula One has made it look easy simply because Formula One has ultimately made a number of very strong decisions and made them quite early on. Now, if you consider how much grief Formula One was getting, Chase Carey, the previous chief executive, was getting, and Ross Brawn and pretty well everyone associated with Formula One were getting lots of grief in Australia with the cancellation of the 2020 Grand Prix on the Friday morning. Of course, now with the benefit of hindsight, you can see that actually that was a brave call, and you know, the timing wasn't ideal. They were really dealing with a very fast moving situation, and so they made that call, and here we are a year later and they're not making a last minute decision. They've made a good call in plenty of time, and I think that really has, you know, the more I took a look at the financial impact of COVID and the business impact of COVID on Formula One, the more you realize that it was causing deep stress across teams, across the whole sports governing body, the FIA having to redefine what championships would or wouldn't take place, when races would be sanctioned or not sanctioned, which racetracks could host races, and of course Formula One itself. Where are we going to race? How are we going to race? And that four-month hiatus that then occurred from March through to June, my word, they made good use of those kind of 16 weeks to come up with what then became a 17-race world championship. And, it, I mean, ultimately, the my conclusion to my piece is that Formula One did an extraordinary job in making, I mean, when I say Formula One, I mean all of the stakeholders did a formidable job in making Formula One happen in 2020. That was good for everyone. It was good for us guys. It was good for the magazine that we, you know, that we love so much, because it enabled us to have something that kept our industry moving. But it wasn't without deep costs. And as so often in recent years, you really had to look at two of the previous giants of Formula One, McLaren and Williams, to see the devastating impact that COVID really had. In a nutshell, COVID came pretty close to burying Williams. They put the team up for sale. Fortunately, they were able to find a buyer in the middle of a global pandemic. And the reason they were able to find that buyer, I believe, was that two other things happened, partly because of the global pandemic. I really do think that, you know, from talking to people across the sport, talking to team principals, the budget cap and then the subsequent agreement on the Concord, the Concord agreement, I mean, they weren't driven solely by what was happening, but the pandemic really helped everyone to focus their minds on survival, on surviving, on getting to a better future, on having a stable world championship. All of a sudden, it was an existential threat, not just to one team, but to the whole sport. So everyone had to be prepared to tighten their belts and do the right things. So Williams could so easily have been buried in the past year with what happened, actually, and, you know, with what's continuing to happen now in 2021. McLaren, on the other hand, they haven't sold the whole company, but they've sold effectively a third of the Formula One team. There was a very public, rather embarrassing scrabble around for much needed cash into the McLaren group, thanks to the complete collapse in sales of the automotive business in the early part of the year. And so the more I got into this feature, the more you felt that, you know, what we hear about, what we read about in the press statements that come out from the teams, this was, I mean, not just a tip of the iceberg. I mean, this was huge stress across a whole industry being dealt with by team principals, by their shareholders, by all the stakeholders. And I've tried to wrap that up into this feature.
Into the space of six or eight pages. It's quite a lot of ground to get over, and we've kind of covered a few of the side issues elsewhere in the mag, haven't we? For instance, the McLaren sort of partial sale of McLaren Racing is actually quite fascinating, isn't it? Because the guy who's behind that is the chap who allegedly, popular culture has it, the guy on whom the character of Jerry Maguire was based. You know, show me the money. Yeah.
Show me the money.
As a sports agent.
How many decisions about Formula One are coming from America? You know, coming from investors in America, coming from the investment community in America. You think of Doralton Capital. Okay, Doralton Capital in New York might be acting on behalf of someone who, by all accounts, lives in the Channel Islands. But the reality is that you've got Liberty, you've got Doralton, you've got MSP. So you've got all of the, you've got a lot of interesting dynamics happening within Formula One. But what's really, you know, for me, becoming a big takeaway about this year of chaos is how strongly Formula One is emerging from it. And yes, we're going to have more disruption in 2021. But when you look at the broad sweep of what's happened across the sport, the way teams have fought to survive, the way Liberty have restructured the sport, the way the FIA have enabled that, the fact that Renault recommitted, you know, Renault recommitting to Formula One in the middle of a global pandemic, and Aston Martin, thanks to Lawrence Stroll, you know, rebranding the whole Racing Point team. Lots of positives emerging from this period of stress. You'd have to really say that the entrepreneurs within Formula One have risen to the challenge of Formula One. I think that entrepreneur mindset has never been stronger. So faced with potentially catastrophe, so many of the people now involved in our industry have actually seen it as an opportunity to create something positive for the future.
Where do you think that that belief in the underlying strength of Formula One has come from? Because it's easy to get wrapped up in the short term devastation, and you know, that's fair enough, because, you know, pandemic's hitting everybody hard and all kinds of businesses even ones like Formula One who've been quite robust and managed to keep the show on the road. But there's probably going to be more damage done if this season doesn't proceed normally. Obviously, Formula One's issued a 23-race calendar. They hope for fans to come back. But already you've got Stefano Domenicali talking about needing to be flexible. Maybe fans won't be welcome till the second half of the season. That has a knock-on impact on the promoters and what they pay for the races and how they fund their businesses. It has a knock-on effect for the sponsors of Formula One who can't meet their clients' needs and therefore can't get their money into Formula One. So how does Formula One ride out that short-term storm, and what gives all these people with this entrepreneurial mindset confidence that there will be a bright future the other side of it?
I have an opinion, which is that Liberty, in taking over Formula One, have given our sport a fundamental strength over the last 4 years. You know, it was January 2017 that effectively Bernie Eccleston was shown the door and Chase Carey took over. And here we are 4 years later, and you look at what Liberty have achieved in that time. They've grown the World Championship calendar. They have brought in some new deals, even if, you know, for example, the Aramco deal, which we talked about, the Saudi Arabian deal, has, you know, raised a few eyebrows, quite naturally. But the fact is that they seem to have stabilised the championship. I think there's also a really important point, which is that because Liberty has is a public company, there are these quarterly investment calls. So Liberty has been effectively selling Formula One to the broader investment community every quarter for the last 4 years. So if you're in a private equity company, if you're a fund manager somewhere in the world, and you're looking at sports opportunities, Liberty is there, and they're saying, buy the shares in our business because we're working really hard to grow it. And then you look at the fact that they've done some very strategic things, which, you know, frankly, Bernie would have resisted, I think, in the past, such as the Netflix series. And key decisions like that have really raised awareness of Formula One to broader audiences. So it's kind of interesting that despite the fact that Formula One is being completely dominated in the hybrid era by one team, actually there's a sense that Formula One as a sport has become stronger because Liberty have given it a much more open style of management. You know, those dim days when the headlines were all about bribery trials involving the chief executive of Formula One in Germany and all those upsets of the days gone by, we're not seeing that anymore. We're actually seeing very smooth transition of management within Liberty. Liberty haven't gotten everything right. And if you look at their management team has effectively had quite a change over the last, you know, particularly the last 2 years. We've seen people in sponsorship come and go. We've seen people in commercial side come and go. We've seen Chase Carey return to the United States. But then you look at the fact that he has handed the baton over to none other than Stefano Domenicali. And when you read, I mean, even the article that I wrote previously about Stefano Domenicali, his arrival in Formula One as chief executive is seen by the whole industry as overwhelmingly positive. And then Liberty are telling their investment community that Stefano Domenicali is the right guy to run Formula One. So you're seeing this very, very consistent communication into the investment community that Formula One is a fundamentally solid business and it only has growth potential for the future. And I think at a time when COVID was having such a devastating impact on world sport, on entertainment, on live entertainment, the fact that Liberty pulled the rabbit out of the hat by having a 17-race Formula One World Championship actually really underlined the strength of Formula One. And it does. This is why I think people like Doralton, you know, they turn up at Williams's door and they see a team which is effectively now a franchise. If you consider that under the new terms of the Concord Agreement, things like a new entrant can't come into Formula One unless they stick up $200 million. There aren't going to be new entrants into Formula One. So that means if Porsche decides that they really like the new engine regulations in the second half of this decade, if they like the move towards synthetic fuels, for example, which I think Porsche will like, actually, you know, it would make no sense for Porsche to set up their own team. They really will want to partner with a Red Bull Racing or with a Williams. And so I think we've seen a lot of confidence injected into Formula One under Liberty's stewardship. And yeah, we're seeing the results of that now.
Do we think that the Jenson Button move this week as a sort of a special advisor, minister without portfolio at Williams, is part of that move towards having a sort of a figurehead at the top of that franchise, someone whose kind of star quality makes that team and that franchise more investable?
I'm not sure it's about having a figurehead so much as that. You know, the team have brought in Jos Capito as chief executive. He's got a formidable CV. I mean, he's one of the most impressive people in world motorsport. He's won World Rally Championship events. He's, you know, worked at Porsche. He's worked at Sauber. He's worked at BMW. He, quite frankly, I think McLaren missed a trick in keeping him there. He went there very briefly during all the changes that were happening, but prior to the new management under Andrea Seidel being brought in. But the
Ron Dennis, the reality, politics victim, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah, politics got in the way. Absolutely, politics got in the way. But I mean, Jos Capito is an incredible individual, I think, for Williams to have been brought in as chief executive. And then Simon Roberts as team principal. Those two together represent a very strong lineup. And I don't think they need any help in terms of public profile. I think the media will enjoy working with both of them. Jos Capito is a really good guy to talk to. Simon Roberts knows Formula One inside out. Jenson Button's role as senior advisor is a very broad opportunity. Williams can use him for PR. They can use him with sponsors. They can use him as an ambassadorial role. If you're a sponsor or a potential sponsor of Williams, you're going to have Jenson Button sitting there in front of you. Everyone knows Jenson Button. He's globally famous. He's become so articulate as a speaker. He is also going to be able to give advice to the management. But when I think of the kind of advice, he's not going to be telling the drivers how to drive the car or the engineers how to design the car or run the car, but he's going to be a useful sounding board. And the great thing about having someone like Jenson come in is, you know, if Jos Capito wants to have a sounding board to have a bit of a discussion about, you know, some of our fundamental strengths or weaknesses in the business, to have someone like Jenson there is going to be useful, because former world champions do know what it takes to make that breakthrough. And I think one of the things about Williams in its new form is, if you look at the three directors, none of the three directors of the team have ever been in Formula One before. Jos Capito has never run a Formula One team before. Simon Roberts is the closest they have to someone who's run a Formula One team before. Actually having Jenson Button in there means they have someone who's won a world championship, worked with some of the greats in the industry, and I have no doubt that he will have useful input. But I think that's a very broad internal and external ambassadorial role for Jenson.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark. It's the sort of role he's kind of had before, hasn't he? When he was kind of not retiring at McLaren, he was ambassador for a bit. You know, did a lot of work for Honda, then subbed for Fernando Alonso when he decided to do the Indy 500 for the first time. I'm not sure Jenson will be called on to drive for Williams if Nicholas Latifi fancies the Indy 500 or some other race.
He might want to do some world endurance racing.
Yeah, I mean, he's still got his own thing, of course, hasn't he? He's got his Extreme E team and he's very active, so no, he's still racing. It's not like he's just been sitting on a beach somewhere for the last few years. But I think more pertinently, he provides that kind of rallying point for the team, doesn't he? Someone with a great track record, world championship behind them. It's good marketing for the team. It's good for sponsors. It's also just good for people who've been in the team a long time to see one of their boys come home and give them the benefit of his breadth and depth of experience competing at the front of Formula One, albeit some time ago, and also with some of the biggest teams the championship's known. So, positive story for Williams, but probably the key things happening in the background have been the appointment of Capito and the strengthening of the management team as Derilton starts to put its own stamp on that structure without obviously upending the tradition and the family feel that they're so keen to maintain, having taken over that franchise.
It's interesting that we touched on Jos Capito's brief time at McLaren when he was hired by Ron Dennis, who was then subsequently ousted in a Game of Thrones Red Wedding style management bloodbath, where something similar but perhaps a little bit less bloody appears to have happened at Renault, where Cyril Abiteboul has has been clearly shown the door. And that was kind of the subject of my column this month, where we sort of look at that. And from my point of view, it's a related issue to the whole Capito Dennis axis, in that sometimes when you're associated with one senior person, when that person is then ousted or noted into retirement, your P45 is already in the post, pretty much, isn't it? So there was a feeling when Jerome Stoll retired from his role as Renault Sport boss back in December that Cyril would not be too loosely lodged in his slipstream out the door, and that was very much the case, wasn't it? It was announced as a sort of a postscript in a press release announcing various other things before Davide Brivio was announced as the new racing director of the Alpine F1 team. So what do we make of that? I mean, my pet theory is that the new CEO is sort of Italianizing Renault anyway, which is why Brivio's been brought in. And I'm sure it won't have escaped his notice what happened a few years ago when Frédéric Vasseur was brought in as racing director of Renault, and he and Cyril basically didn't get on, or he didn't get the autonomy he wanted, so he then moved on. So, you know, if I were Davide Brivio, I would have made it a condition of my employment that Cyril was moved well out of my bailiwick.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think I read your column with great interest, because Cyril, to me, is a very earnest guy. He's clearly got a good intellect. He's been a little bit divisive. The relationship with Christian Horner, as we know, and you mentioned it in your column, was never good. It was toxic, and then it got worse, I think. it was pretty dreadful. And, you know, considering that Red Bull was a customer of Renault and paying for those engines, was it too much to ask to do whatever was necessary? Now, I know Helmut Marko can be impossible to make happy under any circumstances, but there was something just not quite right. It felt like Cyril had ambitions, which meant that relationship was almost destined to fail. And of course, he really should have been doing everything he could to retain Renault's customer base. And I think the fact that Renault ended up with no customers in Formula One is a blot on the copybook, because the commercialism of Formula One, we just a few minutes ago were talking about the entrepreneurialism of Formula One in the middle of the global pandemic. Well, you know, the new boss of Renault Group, he's looking at F1 and he's saying, so why are we the only team that, oh, well, at least we've got McLaren. Oh, no, we haven't got McLaren. They've got Mercedes engines next season. You know, that's like, why is that happening? Why are we spending all this money on R&D and Viri and getting our hybrid engine? I mean, bearing in mind that Renault lobbied for the whole hybrid formula in the first place, and they've ended up with no customers. And I find it really quite intriguing. I have to tell you, one of the first times I met Cyril was at the Monaco Grand Prix in 2011. And I was running Cosworth at the time. And I was invited to a meeting with him and Jean-François Cobé, who was running Renault Sport at the time. And and I was kind of slightly surprised to be invited into the Renault motorhome for a meeting. I wasn't quite sure what they were going to discuss. And they said, we just wanted to tell you, we will be taking the Williams engine deal off you next year. And that was the first that we heard of it at Cosworth. It was the first we knew that Williams were going to go elsewhere. Renault were telling us. And I remember sitting in that meeting, looking at the two of them and thinking, this is really a really interesting approach. You know, you've chosen, and Adam Parr at Williams is aware of this meeting taking place, but is this the way in which Williams and Renault want to interact with other people in the paddock to tell you that you're going to have your deal, you know, taken away from you? So I found it quite combative and unnecessarily so. And of course, what was really interesting was then when Williams announced that they were going with Renault, there was a whole sort of relaunch of Williams with Renault, and Renault were telling everyone this was they were going back to the good old days of Williams Renault. And I remember they did a launch which they had Damon Hill and Jacques Villeneuve and various other drivers come to. And of course, nothing could have been further from the truth, because Renault just weren't putting the money in to Williams that was needed to return Williams to the front of the grid, and frankly the engine wasn't that good, and so it was a really interesting insight into how individuals, and I'm not just saying this was all down to Cyril because he reported to Jean-François Cobert at the time, but it was interesting to see the way in which individuals were prepared to sort of work within continuing the Piranha Club, as it's been called in the past, and it's unnecessarily so. You don't need to do business like that. So when I then saw what happened with, you know, Cyril taking leadership role at Renault, and then that sort of toxic relationship with Renault, with Red Bull Racing, it didn't really come as a surprise, because if you see snipers in the undergrowth at every turn, if you think people are out to get you, that it's all about dog eat dog, that if that's your modus operandi, then it's going to lead to difficult places in the future. So I think ultimately the way this has ended for Cyril is sad, because he's clearly passionate about the sport. But as you say, Cotters, you know, the new boss at Renault has clearly taken a look, decided that Formula One is the right place for them to be. They're going to rebrand all around Alpine, major decision to do that. And then to then decide, actually, Cyril's not the right man for this job going forward. It's quite a striking call.
It's been quite a tough job for him as well, given the situation Renault were in, then trying to come back as a works team. Obviously, he's been a central part of that, but he's always had this juggling act to do between financing or securing investment for the works team to build up, while also maintaining the engine program, but also trying to do it a little bit on the cheap. I mean, Cyril's been quoted before as saying his plan was always to do it on 85% of the resource of the big teams or of Mercedes. This is pre-budget cap, obviously. And it's always felt like they've had to chuck extra resource at the engine project because that, you know, they lobbied for the rules, but then got left behind because they focused on the wrong elements of that from the start. And that meant the team suffered. And then, I know we need to build up Enstone and rebuild elements of that because it's been gutted by, you know, the latter part of the Lotus days. And that means then the engine's kind of not getting the attention. Then Red Bull, your chief customer, gets unhappy. And then the personal relationships come in and they fall out. And then you lose an income stream and that hurts you further because suddenly you've got to find money from elsewhere to plug the gap. And then, you know, we hear recently that Sauber, Alfa Romeo were considering maybe not renewing their Ferrari deal and maybe going with Renault. And you can imagine that while Cyril was in charge at Renault, would Fred Vasseur want to do a deal with Renault? Probably not. So you suddenly see that, you know, people have it's a small industry, and the same people really going round and round in different roles. So if you do fall out with people for whatever reason, it can be very hard to rebuild those bridges, and that can end up costing you. And of course, it feels like Renault just being left behind in many ways. You've got they've done a lot of work on the engine side, and they do have a quite competitive power unit now, but it's almost too late to really make a big deal of that with everything kind of converging. And you've got teams doing deals with other teams, quite close collaborations between Ferrari, previously Alfa Romeo, now Haas, Mercedes getting closer to Racing Point, now Aston Martin, Williams now taking more bits from them, McLaren going back to them, and there's nowhere really for Renault to match up. And all the different elements, even developing their junior drivers, become difficult because they don't have customer teams to place them with, and it just feels like they almost need a reset. And also on top of that, you've seen quite a lot of change in other parts of the management structure, and people like Marcin Budkowski, who we understand might become team principal as part of this reshuffle, you know, bought in by Cyril. You can end up with too many chiefs, and we've talked about Jos Capito McLaren period. It was always difficult when McLaren under that structure had Ron Dennis still nominally in charge, and then Eric Boulier as racing director, and then Capito brought in someone to sit sort of alongside him, and it never worked and never was going to work. And you kind of feel with the boardroom level changes at Renault, having Cyril there and then Budkowski and then Brivio coming in, how do they all fit together? How are they all going to work together? And like Cotter said in introducing the point, it doesn't it sounds like maybe Rivio has seen that coming and thought, well, it's not going to work if we're all there stepping on each other's toes. You need to have kind of a clear demarcation between roles and a clear reporting structure. And I think Cyril, with all the legacy going on and the fact that, you know, when new people take over, it's quite common that they want allies or friends, people that they know they can trust to help them run things, that he was probably going to bite the bullet.
You make a very good point early on there, Ben, about, I mean, quite literally, what goes around comes around. You know, this is a small industry. And it didn't used to matter so much because the team principals owned the team. And when it was Ron Dennis and it was Frank Williams and it was Ken Tyrrell and Tom Walkinshaw and Eddie Jordan, the Piranha Club was full of people who had not just skin in the game, they owned the game, they owned the teams. People like Cyril and Christian Horner, and I mean, it's something that, in fact, as you know, I'm going to be writing about in my column next month. We now are in this era where you have the professional managers. And the thing about the professional managers is that they can be hired and they can be fired. And so therefore you have to, what goes around really is you know, is going to come around. And if you make the wrong decisions and you upset enough people, as you say, you then find that customers are unwilling to do business with you. And it's one of the really interesting dynamics of Formula One that on a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, everyone is bitterly competitive to win the race. And when it comes to sponsorship deal, everyone is bitterly competitive to get those sponsorship deals. But actually, in a number of areas in Formula One, you need to be collaborative. You need to be able to work together, to sit in those meetings, to think about the whole sport, take a holistic view of the sport, and about your team's role within the sport. So when you fall out comprehensively with Red Bull, you fall out with 20% of the grid. And that's arguably not a great decision if you want to be in the business of selling technology solutions. And if your parent company is only willing to give you a small amount of money and you need to be selling powertrain solutions in order to generate additional bottom line and profitability and revenue. And by the way, when you sell engine technology, powertrain technology, it's not just a transactional relationship. It's a deeply embedded relationship. You learn a lot from working with a customer team. And again, at Cosworth, that was something that I found very interesting. You know, we learned so much about working with four very different styles of teams. You can see the strengths and the weaknesses in each. And so I think, yes, it's been an unfortunate episode, you know, to see Cyril leave pretty kind of unceremoniously, because he has played a key role in Formula One over the last decade and clearly has a deep passion for it. But as you know, rightly point out, these things come round and decisions have to be made. And ultimately, it's been David Rivio who's coming in. Although his final title is not yet confirmed, isn't that right?
I think he might be called Racing Director. If memory serves, there might have been a press release.
Yeah, that's an interim title. We used to have interim cars in Formula One. You now have interim titles in Formula One. So there'll be a David Rivio Racing Director B-Spec announced in due course.
I suppose, you know, we will be living through the legacy of Cyril for the next couple of years in terms of drivers, because obviously he was one of the principal architects in bringing Fernando Alonso back. And we haven't really talked that much about drivers, and we do have a beautifully punchy story by Andrew Benson in this issue about what makes the very best drivers stand out from what's already an elite group. And he names four. Who are head and shoulders above the rest. That group does not include Sebastian Vettel or Daniel Ricciardo. Some listeners may object. Do you think Andrew is being an Alonso fanboy again in this piece, or has Fernando still got it?
Well, I'd explain the rationale behind this story, because we spent, Andrew and I, a lot of time working on and finessing the brief to make sure that this story...
Yeah, I've been very flippant, haven't I? You need to adumbrate a little more, yes.
And I think Andrew's love of Fernando Alonso is a well-worn subject and a bit of an inside joke in the media. Obviously, he's an incredible driver, and he wouldn't have been signed up for Renault or Alpine, as it will now be known, if he didn't still have it. But the way we approach this story is that... he's used the teams as a way of identifying it. So if you take Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull and Renault Alpine as the four major teams, i.e. ones with proper manufacturer might behind them, they will try to pick the very best drivers they can to be the flagship for their efforts. So Mercedes, Ferrari and Red Bull, obviously they have Lewis, Hamilton, Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc as a kind of standout guys. Lewis's contract negotiations are ongoing, but these three are the guys those teams are building their near-term futures around. And for Renault Alpine, once Ricciardo stepped away, Alonso is the guy that they've gone for. And I mean, Cyril has argued, and many could argue, that that's potentially an upgrade given Alonso's track record. So the Ricciardo question is quite interesting, and one that Andrew actually wrestled with a bit, because you could argue that he, and he does in the feature, that Ricciardo's a little bit too good to be put alongside one of those other A-spec drivers. Not that he would cause trouble with his personality, but just, you know, with his sheer pace and level of performance. So it's a difficult dynamic to handle, but he's not quite good enough to command one of those seats automatically. So he kind of sits in a group that's maybe just behind the absolute elite. So the rationale is that the teams, really the big teams, decide by who they pick. And then the feature goes on to explore the kind of traits of driving and personality, etc., they have that make them stand apart and mean that the teams gravitate towards them. Ricciardo's the kind of, he's the in-between, because he saw off Vettel, so you can't really argue that Vettel is really among the elites, because, well, Ferrari gave him notice, didn't they, a year before his contract was due to end. You know, they saw what Leclerc was capable of and went, okay, we've got a new guy now, we don't need Sebastian. Red Bull weren't going to hire him back. Mercedes weren't going to hire him. And, you know, Ricciardo was the beginning of the end for Vettel, really, because he went into Red Bull as a new driver in 2014 and got the better of him. So, you know, once that happens, it's very hard to argue that you can be considered in that same group. And Ricciardo has a problem, of course, that the same thing happened to him when Max came along. It was very close for a while, but Max, season after season, got better and better and better. And even the Ricciardo camp would admit, as they did even as early as, I think, Malaysia 2017, I remember having a chat with his family, and they were thinking about, you know, the contractual situations and, you know, who would command what and who would go where. And I think they could see already the tide turning against Daniel, and that Red Bull was about Max Verstappen. And legitimately, Max was commanding that attention because he was becoming quicker than Daniel. So it's hard to argue that Daniel Ricciardo, as great a driver as he is, and as entertaining as he is, and as brilliant a bloke as he is, can belong in that elite category when Max Verstappen was fundamentally quicker than him in the same car, and Daniel then left the team rather than try to fight back against that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting feature. I think, and you know, Andrew has nicely summarized the strengths of these top guys, and it's actually great to see it in black and white, because we talk about it a great deal, you know, about Charles Leclerc, about Max Verstappen, about Lewis Hamilton, but it's actually good to see it, you know, that actually outlined. So let's face it, these are the top guys. I don't particularly have any problem with Andrew putting Fernando Alonso in there, mainly because Fernando Alonso is a great driver. And I think if we're just talking about driving ability, Fernando Alonso has proved so many times that he's right up there. He's a superlative talent. Unfortunately, the thing that has gotten in Fernando Alonso's way is the things that he does and says out of the car that have, I think, kind of interrupted the flow of his career. And just going on the back of what we were talking about, Cyril Abitbol, it is a small industry. What goes around does come around. You can upset, as a driver, you can maybe upset one team as their incumbent driver, but you can't do what Fernando did at McLaren, which was to be in the centre of a storm with the whole Honda debacle, and to be so publicly critical. I think really, I don't think that did his reputation any good whatsoever. And so Fernando Alonso, the person in terms of the way he approaches things, that's a separate story. But I think in this feature, to have seen the way, and also the people that Andrew took the time to speak to, you know, I also had spoken to Paddy Lowe about Lewis Hamilton a couple of months ago. And when you talk to Paddy about what it is that makes Lewis Hamilton so good, his ability to be so adaptable, and adaptability seems to be the factor with all of these greats, and it's something that we know from the greats of years gone by. The fact you put them in the car, that they can catch it. If the car starts to get away from them, they have this inherent ability to carry speed, to keep carrying speed, to not to drive around a problem so much as to engineer a solution that's going to work for them, so that that's going to give them what they want. And I think Andrew very nicely summarizes in relation to Sebastian Vettel the fact that, you know, give Sebastian Vettel a car that he's completely content with and he's amazing. You know, he's a very, very rapid driver. Give Sebastian Vettel a car that's not giving him what he's happy with, and he struggles. And as Andrew says in the feature, you know, Ferrari came to pretty conclusive decision that Sebastian didn't represent a future for them. On the Daniel Ricciardo thing, I think it's a really interesting point, I think, to discuss. And I'd be interested, you know, Ben, in your thoughts. I mean, you talk about the fact that Daniel went into Red Bull Racing and he gave Sebastian Vettel a hard time and he beat Sebastian Vettel. And then he struggled against Max Verstappen. But of course, you and I know that in the case of Max Verstappen, Red Bull as an organisation, both the Formula One team and the wider Red Bull company, have their arms wrapped around Max Verstappen. He's getting absolutely unstinting support. And I often look at drivers like Daniel Ricciardo and I think, I wonder what would happen if they went into a team that gave them unstinting support, that really got behind them. And, you know, I do think if Andreas Seidel and Zak Brown can do the job with Daniel Ricciardo that I think they can do, he might well be in Andrew Benson's feature in a year's time because he will have made that step. And again, a point that Andrew makes very well in the feature is the fact that you know, Daniel went to Renault and there was a kind of a question mark over that decision. And actually going back, Cotters, to your column about Cyril Abiteboul, you know, Cyril Abiteboul's decision to sign Daniel Ricciardo for a lot of money and Daniel Ricciardo's decision to join Renault for a lot of money were actually questionable decisions for both of them, because actually Cyril could well have done better spending more money on research and development and less money on a driver. And really, Daniel, I mean, a top driver whose name I won't mention just because of the way he described it to me, but I mean, a top driver that I spoke to about Daniel Ricciardo's decision to sign to Renault said to me, he said, "I'm shocked," because he said, "Daniel is cashing in, and he's cashing in too early in his career. He has so much more still to give in terms of competitiveness, and he's cashing in and going to Renault." And, you know, this particular driver said to me, you can forget about Daniel Ricciardo now. He has written himself off. Now, the fact is he only went to Renault in the end for a very short time. So I think Daniel also, having made his money, has realised he has a last chance saloon, and that's represented by McLaren Mercedes. And if he can win Grand Prix at McLaren Mercedes, which I think he's well capable of doing, he might just reassert himself within our sport. And who knows, join that elite group that Andrew has identified.
Yeah, I think he's close. He's probably number five, isn't he? Or, you know, number four if you question the Alonso thing. But I think it's hard when you analyse what's happened in Alonso's career in terms of what he can do in the car to not include him in that category. Yes, he can be divisive and cause problems outside of it, but he has that core adaptability trait. And you've seen it manifest in his previous career. You know, Stoffel Vandoorne up against him in the McLaren. I remember it. Story from, I think it was 2017, where Stoffel was struggling with the braking system on the McLaren, and the system being developed in a way that the engineers thought, well, not thought, they calculated was quicker, but it was very, very difficult to use for the driver. It didn't give the feedback and the feeling that you would want as a driver. And Alonso is so adaptable, he can adjust his style to cope with the things the engineers throw at him that they know will be quicker if you can just have a robot essentially driving the car the way they want. And Alonso is able to do that. He's incredibly efficient in that way. And even a driver as talented as Stoffel, obviously lacking experience, he just couldn't get on with that system. So immediately you have a break between one driver and the other. You've got the engineers going in one direction going, this is quicker. But 95% of drivers won't be able to cope with that system. So you'd normally reject it on the basis that actually you're slower because neither driver can use that clever device. But Alonso can, the other driver can't. So suddenly you have to give the other driver something else that isn't theoretically as quick, but with their technique will be overall better for them. So they'll get more out of themselves. Then you've got a demarcation between the two drivers, and the team eventually has to pick which way they're going to go. And they're always going to go with the driver that best aligns with the fundamental engineering and the theoretical pace of the car. And I think you've seen that manifest in other places as well. We can see it clearly at Mercedes, although Lewis and Bottas get on very well. Bottas just isn't as adaptable in those key situations where things are not predictable. You know, you stick the car with on a dry circuit with new tyres, good setup for qualifying, and Bottas is within a tenth of a second often of Lewis Hamilton's pace, which is a great achievement. But as soon as you get him into dirty air or tyres degrading severely or wet weather, Lewis is still more often than not at the same high level, and Bottas can't go with him. And you'll see that manifest, I'm sure, in some of the engineering decisions that the team make in terms of how they drive the development of the car. It's the same for Ricciardo and Max. You know, Max is really, it's that fundamental comfort with a car misbehaving in a corner, particularly oversteer. Max is just able to hang on to it. And Daniel always found that whenever the car was a bit leery at the rear, he would struggle to go with Max. And then as soon as you got to circuits where you needed a bit more rear grip and maybe had to dial a bit more understeer in fundamentally to cope with the overall demands of the circuit somewhere like the A1 ring, it brought things back towards him. And you see again with Lewis, usually his teammates are much closer or better than him at the A1 ring. It's one of those circuits where he doesn't perform quite so exceptionally, and that's just probably a fundamental way of setting up the car. But more often than not, you put these drivers into a situation where things are always a compromise, but you have to make difficult choices about, you know, where you throw the setup and, you know, which ill traits you have to keep in the car. Those guys can get around it. Leclerc's the same. He's got this flamboyant style where the car can just be misbehaving and sliding all over the place, and he can still wrestle a lap time from it, and Sebastian Vettel can't. I think the feature is very instructive of what we saw across the 2020 season, why you had these differences between teammates in the top teams. And it comes down to that fundamental adaptability, not only to conditions, but also, you know, how the car is engineered for ultimate lap time. They can get the most out of it. And I think in Leclerc's case, to see Sebastian Vettel, a driver with such a great track record, you know, huge achievement, to question the quality of his own equipment against his teammate, must have really, really got inside his head to see what Leclerc was doing. I'm sure Sebastian, Bottas, Alex Albon were looking at the data traces when comparing to their teammates and just thinking, I mean, Bottas has admitted it, I think, in a recent interview with our sister title, motorsport.com, that sometimes he'll look at the data and he just won't know how Lewis has done that. And that's the black art that Andrew's dealing with in his feature, this bit of magic that some drivers can do and others, as good as they are, and these are all incredible drivers, they just can't quite get to that level unless conditions are just right for them. And unfortunately, Seb is in that category. He's like Kimi Raikkonen, isn't he? Kimi Raikkonen, another great driver, great achievement.
You're about to commit blasphemy.
But he needs the car a certain way. But Raikkonen at least has been absolutely brutally honest and upfront about it throughout his career. Whenever you speak to him or the people who work with him, he says, I don't like understeer. I want rear grip. And usually the drivers who are less adaptable, that's the thing they say. They want the rear to be settled so they can nail the throttle. That's why Daniel Ricciardo's been more competitive in the Renault this year, because they've given him that trait. So he feels confident. Again, he can get more out of himself, but I'm sure the car could fundamentally be a bit quicker if you set it up a different way. But he wouldn't like that, so he'd go slower. But Raikkonen's always said, I don't like understeer. I always hated it. So I want you to engineer the car around that. And if you trust my feedback, because I've got a great feeling for this, and you can engineer that grip into the car, I will achieve some incredible results. And he has done, but you can't always do that. It limits the range in which you can perform at your best. It was the same for Jenson Button, similar traits in his driving. You know, he hated it was the other way around though. He hated oversteer, so you had to give him understeer and then he would perform really well. But of course you can't always do that. Sometimes the nature of the circuit, the way the tyres are, etc., you're going to have to set the car up a different way to overall get a better lap time, and he would struggle. So it's in this way that you can see the differences between the very best and the very, very good. And I think it's a great feature, because, and one that it was important to do at this time of year when it's quiet, because, as you said, Mark, this is the kind of thing that you can talk endlessly about, and it's something I think all Formula One fans enjoy talking about too. You know, why is one driver better than the other? What stands them apart? We talk often about how it's an equipment dominated sport, and, you know, I think Carlos Sainz put it quite well, you know, pretty much every driver on the grid, not all of them, I don't think, but most could win races in Lewis Hamilton's Mercedes, but very, very few, maybe none, could beat him across the season in that car. And so there are fundamental differences between these guys, and that's what we're trying to get into here. I think it's a fascinating topic.
I think, Ben, there's a good follow-up feature to be had on analysing how the heck the Valtteri Bottases and their ilk cope with this reality, being the teammate to the elite driver. And of course, none of them ever like to talk about it, because it's a kind of an admission of the place that they're in. I remember a story, and I don't know if it's an apocryphal one, but I remember a former lodger of mine, Eddie Irvine, telling me that at one particular test session with Michael Schumacher, that they had identical setups on the car and were unable, he just wasn't able to get the same lap time as Michael. Looked at the data, couldn't understand how Michael was taking a particular corner absolutely flat, and decided after lunchtime he would go out and copy Michael's performance. He would just take the data and say, right, well, that's the way the car can go around this track, I'll drive it. And I said to Eddie, so what happened? I said, did you match his time? He said, well, he said, when I regained consciousness, I realized that I hadn't actually made it. So there was, you know, it is a really interesting dynamic, isn't it, that you can sit in those engineering meetings and look at the data from your teammate and think, how on earth are they able to do that? It must, over a long period of time, become quite soul-destroying. So I'm not surprising Valtteri Bottas has taken himself off to as far north as he possibly can this winter with his girlfriend to enjoy a good break from Formula One, because I could imagine facing up to Lewis Hamilton every weekend is a pretty wearying experience.
I'm not sure he's quite had his moment of full realisation yet. I think there's different approaches, aren't there? I think Irvine, his approach was going eyes wide open. You know, I'm not going to beat Schumacher. I don't expect to. I'm here to do a job as number two, and I'm happy to...
Here to cruise and collect.
Yeah, and not totally, because obviously he's a competitive guy, but I'm sure he knew what he was getting into, and then a story like Mark's just told where he sees it for himself and goes, right, okay, I'll give it a go. No surprise, it didn't work. So I'll settle into it, I'll accept it. And if you've accepted it mentally, then you know your job is just to get the most out of yourself and support the efforts of the team. Then you can have what has been described as your DC moment, where actually you fancy yourself as a pretty good driver, and maybe you've got a chance. You know, you came in obviously to a top team and won races, and maybe you thought, oh yeah, I've got a championship in me. And then of course you got Mika Hakkinen, and it took him a bit of time to realise maybe that, or accept that Mika was on a higher level. But once he did, his time got a bit easier, shall we say, mentally, and he was able to perform at a pretty high level. I think Bottas is still in that space where he feels he's got a chance to beat Lewis. He just needs to, you know, dig a bit deeper. But you could argue that maybe he would have an easier time, or maybe even get more out of himself and perform slightly better in the World Championship overall if he just accepted that it's not going to happen. But to do that, you know, it's you're kind of committing a kind of cardinal sin of competitiveness, aren't you? You're fundamentally accepting that someone's better than you and you can't beat them. And no professional hyper-competitive athlete wants to do that. So very, very difficult position to be in. But, you know, if eventually, as time goes on, if you can't turn the tide somehow, results speak for themselves, don't they? And I recall a story from Alexander Sims when he was upcoming through the junior categories. He was teammates to Bottas in Formula 3. And he had a similar moment racing alongside Bottas. They did an event on the Brands Hatch Indy circuit when the European Formula 3 Championship used to, or Euro Series as it was called, supported the DTM. Very short lap. You know, I think they do Paddock Hill Bend flat in those Formula 3 cars, which is insane in itself, really. So, you know, once you've got that one nailed, you've got the Druids hairpin, Graham Hill Bend, the little piff-paff and then clearways. So not much, really, where you can make up time. But I remember Sims telling me years ago that Bottas was just quicker through Graham Hill Bend every lap, and he just couldn't work out from the data why that was. You know, and he's a very intelligent guy. Obviously spent a lot of time looking at it, thinking about it, poring over the wheres and why fors, and couldn't do it. And I think that was the point that he, in his head, realised, well, here's somebody in the same equipment, same car, same team, same track, just doing something I can't do. And I think at that point he realised, well, I'm not going to make it as a Formula One driver or be a Formula One world champion because I've been bested in a way I don't understand. And of course, he's gone on to have a very good career. I think he probably undersold himself. I think, you know, if he'd had a bit more self-belief, he probably could have made it to Formula One and, you know, different opportunities maybe as well, and probably had an okay career in Formula One. But he probably thought to himself, well, I can't achieve my ultimate ambition if I can't understand why this guy is quicker than me. And this must be happening all over the place in different categories and also within Formula One. You know, guys going up against teammates and in the same car and thinking, oh, how is he doing that? And sometimes you'll crack the code and then it's okay. You can get on with your life and breathe a massive sigh of relief. But sometimes you just won't be able to solve the puzzle. And at that point, I think you're done as a potential top line driver. And this is the big challenge Bottas faces. You know, he's had several years now of, you know, that privileged access to the data of what Lewis Hamilton is doing. You know, in the former days, and I'm sure Lewis would much prefer to be in this kind of period where you didn't have, you know, overlay traces and sensors on every single thing the car and the driver were doing, because it would be much more difficult to then work out the differences and more of his secrets would be protected. But there's still, even with this, you know, data saturated modern era of Formula One, bits that you can't understand, stuff the driver does and feels that doesn't show up in the data or can't be explained when you look at the data. That's just one way of looking at the car. So Bottas has got all the information and obviously has made progress, but he can't beat Lewis in the same car. And if he doesn't do it this year, you kind of feel, well, that's it for him, really. He's got to accept that he's not going to be a world champion. Very
it's
difficult.
It's a known
thing.
Unknown, as someone once said. Or is it an unknown known? No, it's a known unknown. Now, before we close up, we've committed one cardinal sin in mentioning Eddie Irvine on this podcast, about to commit another cardinal sin going over the hour, but some fascinating news just overnight before we recorded this podcast of Netflix giving the green light to a film currently slated to star John Boyega and Robert De Niro, set in the world of Formula One, focusing on a promising young Formula One driver who is in hock to the mafia and has to drive for them. So what do we think about that, guys? I mean, Mark, you must be picking yourself up off the floor in amazement at the thought of organised crime getting involved in motor racing.
Yeah, I'm just thinking I could actually give them a few phone numbers of people they could phone to give them storylines. I'm not sure they would believe the storylines. I have actually sat in a restaurant in Milan and been offered a briefcase packed full of cash for a driver to come into racing, and I felt very lucky to escape from that meeting intact. So I think the thought of a film where the mafia are involved is interesting. Robert De Niro, I'm trying to think, would he be a team principal? Trying to think which team principal Robert De Niro would be playing, because presumably he's
tricky.
Not the up-and-coming driver.
Yes, I think that's probably more likely to be John Boyega, isn't it? But is Robert De Niro just sort of basically just lazily cashing in? Well, you know, we mentioned Cruise and Collect. Surely Robert De Niro is equivalent of Cruise and Collect. He's playing some sort of mafiosi.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting... It's going to be an interesting one, isn't it? Well, let's hope they do a good job with it, because they've done a good job with the Drive to Survive series, even though I don't like the title Drive to Survive. But anyway, they've done a good job with the Netflix series on Formula One. Let's hope they have a film. that they really have a choice, haven't they? You either try to make it incredibly realistic, in which case the fans are really happy, or you do the complete opposite. You just suspend all reality and take it into a completely different place altogether. But anyway, it sounds like it'll be an interesting one.
Is it true what I heard about the divorce between Sylvester Stallone and Formula One happened? Because obviously when he was putting together Driven, or Drivel as most people like to call that film, it was originally going to be set in the world of Formula One, and he had it in mind that as a set piece he would leap into a car, a Formula One car that was on display somewhere in a shop window or something, and, you know, turn the key and fire it up and drive it through the streets to chase after someone. And of course everyone he put that to in Formula One just laughed it off. You know, a show car doesn't have an engine in, give it up, mate, it's a stupid idea. And eventually, you know, he walked away, did it with Champ Car, and just such a sequence happens in that film where he leaps into a Champ Car that randomly a display car has an engine in it, and you know, starts on the button, and he's able to tear off down the streets.
I have to tell you that I showed Sylvester Stallone around the Jordan Garage in Montreal during the course of those conversations that he was having with Formula One. He came to the Canadian Grand Prix, and I showed him around the garage, showed him the car, and he managed to kick over our main bodywork stand while I was showing him around the garage. And I watched the engine cover and a couple of nose cones kind of hit the ground. And the mechanic who was standing right behind it was Andy Stevenson, who is, of course, now sporting director of Aston Martin F1. Now, normally, if you kicked over so much as a can of WD-40, Andy would have not been happy with you. But I watched Sylvester Stallone kick over the entire bodywork, and Andy was like, "That's fine, no problem at all." He obviously just like, you know, just a nice smiley face. "Hi, Sylvester, lovely to see you.
I'm not messing with Judge Dredd."
Yeah, exactly. He was treated completely differently. And the other thing I remember about Sylvester Stallone coming to those couple of Grand Prix with us was him sitting in the motorhome one day, and on one of the other tables we had a sponsor, had a couple of guests. One was quite a young woman, quite a young woman, and probably in her sort of early 20s. And, I mean, literally, yeah, who he didn't know. I mean, he had only just met her in our motorhome, and he reached across and he said, "If you come with me to Hollywood, I'll put you in my next movie."
Oh,
and everyone just sat there thinking, did he actually just say those words? Did those words actually come out of his mouth? And, of course, you could see this look in her face, which was a mixture of disdain, excitement, just utter. I mean, I would just love to. I just love to know what she's put that down to in her life. That moment, Sylvester Stallone offered to take her away from it all and make her famous in Hollywood. This was, I have to say, pre Me Too movement.
Wow, it must have been like being propositioned by a giant lizard.
"Come with me, I'll make you put you in my next movie."
It was astonishing. Wrinkly skin. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, we have to say thank goodness that Sylvester did finally give up on the idea of Formula One, because can you imagine if that awful film had finally been about the category of racing that we love so dearly.
I mean, I don't know if you've seen Le Mans 66, but I think that proves that there is a good film to be made about car racing, provided you're not into rivet counting. But I also thought that there is an element of sort of art meets life in this storyline, in that there was a racing driver who admittedly didn't make it to F1, but he was a rival of Jackie Stewart's in Formula 3, and he went to jail for being the getaway driver in the great train robbery. Was it Roy James? Yeah, and funnily enough, after he got out, he was given a job either making or engraving the Formula One Grand Prix trophies by Bernie Eccleston, you know, just as a favour. And I should point out at this point, because our producer Martin will be sweating, that Bernie has always denied any involvement in the Great Train Robbery, and there is no evidence to support any proposition that he was.
The late, great Russell Bulgen, he got an interview with Bernie Eccleston for Car magazine. And the first thing he said to him was, is it true that you were involved in a great train robbery? And I just thought it was so typical of Russell. He basically he did this whole build up about how difficult it had been to get an interview with Bernie Eccleston. So having finally got an interview with Bernie Eccleston, he goes into Six Princes Gate and says, "Hi Bernie, were you involved in the great train robbery?" And then Bernie goes, "I'm so pleased you asked me that, because I'm very happy to answer that question." And he proceeds to, of course, deny any involvement whatsoever. But it's extraordinary. The Roy James story is absolutely bang on. He did make the trophies for Bernie when he got out of prison.
One of my favourite Russell Bulgin pieces, while we're on the subject of his work, is he did that great interview with Nigel Mansell, where he slightly provoked Nigel, who can be a little bit prickly if you don't show him utmost respect. And the interview ended with Nigel walking out and telling him to F off. Well, anyway, we've gone well over the hour, so we're going to have to sign off.
I'm gutted you're going to sign off without talking about that wonderful feature you've done on the Tyrrell 001, one of my favourite cars of all time.
Oh, this is a great feature. Now that was a car, one of the best ones, actually.
Fantastic. Derek Gardner in his garage near Leamington Spa. I mean, how cool.
It's an amazing story, isn't it, to have done that in utmost secrecy and meeting in a pub somewhere where they thought was halfway between Leamington Spa and Ockham. But I think Ken Tyrrell had got it slightly in his favour. I think it was slightly closer to Ockham than it was to Leamington Spa.
Leamington to Henley is a lot further than Ockham to Henley.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I really enjoy researching and writing those ones. I know that some people get triggered when they go up on autosport.com. Very often, it triggers the sort of the more Rivet County people who want everything down to the last 8 decimal places. Details that you basically can't squeeze into a magazine feature that has a tight word count. But I think for sort of the broad audience, just as a sort of a taster, it offers a little glimpse into the world of F1, the background of F1 and Grand Prix motor racing, how it used to be done. Although in the next one, we are moving a little bit forward in time, shall we say, to a slightly more modern car. But it is amazing that just within our lifetime you could have one guy sitting in a car in his bedroom and just drawing a racing car with no experience of actually having built a racing car, because Derek Gardner built gearboxes, he was a transmission expert, just by looking at pictures and working out how things should be, and just doing a really intuitive piece of engineering. So it's a great piece of work.
And then it going on to be the basis for actually fundamentally very successful period as well for the team. Yeah. So it's not like he had a shot and it was all right, but a bit crap for something that's been done by the eye. It was actually really good effort.
it's only because obviously Lotus had more resources and managed to get the 72 on stream in 1970, just a little bit quicker than they were able to finish that car. It might have been a different story. So it only contested a handful of Grand Prix, but was actually, it paved the way for a great deal of success and more Jackie Stewart World Championships, and of course a team that nowadays is still winning World Championships, albeit with a different name above the door and located in a different part of the country.
It's funny though, isn't it, that his design was basically pictures and seeing by eye and then drawing the car, and of course now just recently the rules have been changed to outlaw special 3D copying of cars to produce pictures so that people can then copy the designs and do their own cars. So everything's changed in Formula One, but also nothing has changed.
I think the fact that Derek Gardner was probably advised and subsequently did make the car look a bit like a Matra MS80 meant Jackie Stewart was quite excited to drive it. So Jackie basically got the car that he really wanted, and it literally was tailor made for him, and a beautiful machine and great photography with this piece as well in the magazine.
Yeah, James Mann he does a great job, and he obviously it's been a bit of a struggle for him in the past year, because he relies on getting hold of these cars and taking them into the studio, so it's been a bit trickier for him. But hopefully, as the months progress and the classic car market gets underway, these cars are being bought and sold all the time. People always want brochure pictures for them, and that's how he gets his in, and it enables us to do these features very cost effectively, because studio time's really expensive, and he's able to shoot two a day. Sometimes he can do them outside and make them look like they've been done inside. He's a really, really gifted and great photographer, and very, very fun and knowledgeable guy as well. So he's a great part of the team. Anyhow, now we have gone well over our hour, so we must sign off. And has my headphones gone wrong, or have all the crickets gone silent in the background there, Mark?
We shot them all.
With a pea shooter.
Yeah, it's night time here now, so everything is still, apart from me. I'm the only noise in the village.
Well, we'd better let you go off and make yourself a Horlicks before bed. So thank you very much, Mark. Will you be, but you won't be back in the country next time, will you? You'll be still in
Australia. I don't think I'm allowed back in the country. I mean, not because of a criminal record, but because of the fact that I think Boris is about to bring in mandatory hotel quarantine for returnees to the UK. So having done my 14 days here, I don't really want to do another 14 days in the UK, so I'm going to be staying here
at your own expense as well.
At my own expense, it costs $3,000 here to $3,000 to stay in the quarantine for 2 weeks. So I'll be hoping to come back in the springtime, maybe in
spring
April,
2022.
Like gosh, let's hope it's not spring 2022. No, spring 2021. Ending on a serious note, let's just hope that things do improve rather dramatically in Europe, and that Grand Prix such as Spain and Monte Carlo can perhaps even have just some spectators attend those races, and that we can have those races, because it's looking a bit dubious at the moment.
Obviously, Mark, we don't want you to have to quarantine again, because, you know, presumably you've exhausted Netflix. Its algorithm must say, can't you go for a walk instead when you log into it?
Well, let's hope we have some normality fairly soon. But in the meantime, we're going to stay here, enjoy the Australian sunshine, and hopefully speak to you guys in a month's time about the next edition.
That'll be fab. Thank you very much, Mark. And thank you very much, Ben, for your sagacious contributions and your passionate defence of Daniel Ricciardo.
I can't recall now whether I defended him or attacked him or did both in the same answer. So hopefully producer Martin can make some sense of my waffling on.
This is the podcast of 1,000 years. Anyhow, yes, this has been the Flat Chat podcast. I'm Stuart Codling. The latest GP racing is out on the shelves. Go to gpracing.com to check out our fantastic subscriptions offers. You can also pick up selected elements of our magazine on autosport.com. Our long-suffering producer has been Martin Lee. Thank you very much for listening.